You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right, we continue on All Marine Radio, and joining me from Europe is Chad Buckle, Major, United States Marine Corps, Infantry Type. Chad, first of all, welcome to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
I appreciate you having me on.
All right. First of all, we're going to talk about to Chad a few times because he's written a series of articles, and we'll get into that in a second. But before we do that, we've got to find out if he's legit, if we can trust him. So born and raised where?
New Orleans, Louisiana.
Oh wow! So you're not even part of the American culture. You're part of a fourth nation culture, yes?
Well, you know, it's a blending of everything. I like to think I'm more of a mutt, but we sprinkle in some Americana and we kind of do our own thing down there. It's a good time.
It's a bit intimidating for the rest of us. Are you guys aware of it?
Aware of what?
That we're just not really sure about the whole Louisiana thing. You know, we hear that.
Oh, but you should be. I mean, Bourbon Street is about as American as it gets, right? You
it's a dirty
party place. All night, it's take it easy during the day, a little sweet tea, a little crawfish, a little gumbo. Good.
There you go. All right. So, born and raised there. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar in life?
I was a kid. And you know, like all good kids, I decided to stay up way past my bedtime one night. Saw, you name it, war movie. I was like, hey, you know what? I'm going to do that. And just kind of started getting into the Marine Corps as a kid, and it stuck with me. And here I am today.
So there was no dad, uncle, no other connection, and then just you organically watching things you weren't supposed to watch as a young kid, and that ultimately influences you? That's it?
It pretty much. I guess I'm an easy influence at times. My grandfather fought in the army in Korea.
Okay.
Didn't talk about it much, and I can imagine why. But I think I just always wanted to be in the Marines, and, you know, I kind of followed that path.
So you don't know anything. What about the Marine Corps catches your eye?
Well, I think as a kid, right, I don't know anything, and I'm kind of looking at this military thing, and let's face it, the Marine Corps does advertise them pretty dang good.
Yeah.
You got dragons fighting, and, you know, dudes slaying those dragons, and all of a sudden they dress up their arm, and I'm like, hey, they're pretty bad. I'm gonna figure out what these guys do, and I don't know. It just kind of happened. There was really no path or plan to it, as far as I can remember.
Wow, I'm pretty similar. I didn't have any connection. My dad and uncle served in the army, but never deployed, and. I had seen Marines in and around California growing up here, and they were always pretty squared away. I'd read about them. I'd seen the sands of Iwo Jima, and I thought, if I'm going to be in the military, I'm going to be a Marine. And I never went to any place else, but like you, I didn't have any other connection. It was just me being influenced by the propaganda as a kid. Where'd you go to college?
I went to the Citadel.
Went to the Citadel. All right. That's a pretty crazy choice. Why do you go to the Citadel when you're from Louisiana?
So another random story in my life. I think there's a pattern here. Did the application process for the Naval Academy. Got the congressional recommendation sent in the package. And I get the letter back. And it's not very sad. It's kind of thin. So it kind of tells you right there what they're basically telling you. And the gist of the letter was, hey, you know, we'll take you if you get, I think it was like a 24 or something on your math score in the ACT. I forget the number. So I studied really, really hard, and, you know, I'm garbage at math. I can count to 10, and that's because I have 10 fingers. studied really hard, come up short by a point, you know, get the next letter. Oh, well, nice try. They sent my information on to VMI and the Citadel, and both those colleges sent me some letters saying, hey, if you're interested, you know, go ahead and apply. We're interested in having you. Didn't know anything, not a dang thing about either school. So, like all good decision makers, I flipped a coin. And, well, heads to Citadel. So that's where I applied, and that's where I ended up.
Nice. That's awesome. Wow.
And then, you know, my freshman year, I was choosing my heads versus tails decision on that one a few times. But no, it's a great school, and I'm you know, I could have gone to school in Louisiana and done so free with the TOPS program.
Yeah.
But knowing myself and you know, the friends I had and the discipline I had at that time, it was probably a wiser choice to make new friends elsewhere.
There you go. to make new friends elsewhere. There you go. A man who knows himself. All right, so you do all that, and you come in the Marine Corps. You got to find a job. Talk to us about your choice of occupational specialty.
Yeah, so, you know, my original design was not college. It was to enlist, and my parents essentially threatened my life. So I acquiesced. I showed up to college, and then before the summer break between my freshman and sophomore year, I call up the local recruiter, and I enlist. But the recruiter kind of tossed me off the ledge a little bit, and he's like, hey, why don't you do the reserve thing? You know, stay in school, and then we can potentially look down the future at other options for you. So I do that, off to Parris Island, do my training, and then stay in school. I'm in the reserves. Get through that, do the OCS thing, graduate, go to TBS, and really up to this point, I had no desire to be anything else but infantry. So for anybody who's been to TBS, at least when we went through, they had the black line and the red line.
Oh, what's that? That sounds pretty ominous.
So the black line was they give you a list of all the MOSs possible.
Okay.
They say, okay, rate your MOSs that you want from 1 to, I think it was 24, but I'm probably sounding dumb on that. I don't remember how many MOSs right now.
Okay.
So we list them in order that we want. And they say, draw a black line. And anything above the black line, you really, really want. Anything below the black line, you know, you can live with. And then draw a red line. And anything below the red line, you're like, I'm quitting the Marine Corps. I can't stand it. I don't want anything to do with it.
Wow.
So I write infantry number 1, and then I draw my red line, my black line, and then I list all the rest of the MOSs. Yeah. Which, lucky for me, you know, there was the Afghan and Iraq thing, you know, the thing back in the day that was going on. So someone enthusiastic about going to the infantry. So someone that was enthusiastic about going to the infantry, I'm sure the instructors were doing backflips over. So I was selected to go to IOC, and the rest is history.
All right. Give us about a 60-second thumbnail of your career since then, and we'll talk about your writing.
All right. IOC to Victor 1-6. Took a rifle platoon to Ramadi in 2006-2007. Came back, took a weapons platoon to Afghanistan in 2008. Came back, went to Saudi Arabia from 2009-2010 to do advisory work. Came back, ended up at Edson Range, working or being in charge of the range company for recruits out of San Diego and teaching them marksmanship. From there, went to MCCC, and then from there out to Hawaii with 3-3, where I was the assistant officer, a company commander, and then the operations officer. moved up to regiment for a while to do the assistant op, so at the regiment level. And now I am out at NATO Special Operations Headquarters, doing work for them out here in Belgium.
All right. So let's talk about you've written a series of articles for the Gazette. I tapped into one, got a hold of you, and then found out about the rest of them. So tell, for people that aren't familiar with the series, tell them what you initially intended on doing and how did this series come about?
So, through my limited time, in the Marine Infantry, I noticed, really started to notice it back as a platoon commander, but really, really picked up on it as a company commander and operations officer, that the way our infantry is trained, manned, and equipped, is not necessarily ideal, for today's operating environment. So I started really looking into it. I looked at, you know, how the Marine Corps has evolved over time, what the Marine Corps has done, how it set itself up for World War II, how it set itself up for Korea, Vietnam, and past wars, and kind of the fluctuation of that. And I decided to write the articles because I thought we're kind of at one of those turning points again for our institution, where we have an outdated model in many respects. And, you know, we're buying all this technology. We're buying high-speed aircraft. We're buying, you know, some great vehicles. But we're not really focusing on the warfighter himself and creating that warfighter for the new operating environment and then creating the organization to unleash that warfighter in this environment. So that's really the premise of the article, starting with the individual and working all the way up to the division level, the ground combat element level.
All right. So when you – a lot of times the way guys wind up writing a series of articles is that they write one, and then as they're writing one, they say, you know, I'm really not finished with this. This is going to take me this, and this. But you conceived of this from the start as a series because of the
– Absolutely.
Okay, because of the breadth. All right. But we're gonna pick on one article today, and then we're gonna bring you back, and we're gonna slowly but surely work through your work. So the one we'll start with today. First of all, walk people through the. Can you name off the 6 articles in the series?
Yes. So the first one, entry level training, was really written. I submitted that one for one of the Gazette's contests.
Okay.
And that was the foundation article. The following 5 are titled A Case For, and really I'm arguing a point. So the first one of that labeled series is the Infantry Career Path. So building on that entry-level training, talking about the career path that we should put everybody through from a development point of view.
Okay.
Then I talk about the 15 Marine Rifle Squad, which is a misnomer because I'm not just talking about why 15, but what those roles would be and some of the equipment and enhancements we can do for the squad. Then I talk about the Enhanced Rifle Company, then the Infantry Battalion, and then I talk about the Marine Division, but really I'm kind of talking about the MAGTAF level and the GCE writ large, just using division as the baseline template.
Got it. Okay, so those are now, how many of them have they all been published yet?
No. So 3 have been published to date, and the other 3 are scheduled to be published over the next 3 months.
Got it. So you pretty much own the Gazette right now, right?
I don't know about that. I was hoping, and what I'm hoping to get is a constant drumbeat to spark a conversation, and you know, not just at the senior level, which is obviously my hope, but just throughout the institution about, you know, how do we affect a positive change for our organization for the next fight.
Are you, so let me ask you one question, and then we'll talk about,
okay.
We'll talk about entry-level training. I was fortunate enough to get assigned to be an instructor at the basic school in 1989. And it coincided with General Gray's emphasis at the very early levels of maneuver warfare. I had a chance there to I crossed paths with John Kelly, John Schmidt. I crossed paths with, I'd heard General Gray speak, Colonel Zinni speak, General Van Riper, Mike Wiley, Bruce Goodmanson, Bill Lynn, and then coincidentally at the basic school, you know, was this whole series of captains and lieutenants that were pretty bright guys, General Osterman, General Caporata, General Furness, General Clarity, General Kennedy, all were there as lieutenant captains, and we used to write and argue about how do you do this thing. Is there enough of that intellectual dynamic still in the Marine Corps, or have we been consumed by operational requirements and that been put to the side? I'm curious about your thoughts about that.
I think the answer is yes to both of your questions.
Okay.
I think that the intellectual vigor is still there within the Marine Corps. That's one thing the Marine Corps does, I think, very well with its officer program. As you get more senior, you know, we start choosing the really, 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 really smart people. And we, you know, the pyramid gets steep enough to where the Corps can do that. I do think, though, that operational commitments have overstretched us. I think we can see that in our readiness, whether you want to talk about equipment readiness or training readiness or personnel readiness.
Yeah, any readiness.
Any readiness. I mean, whatever subcategory you want to put it to, I think any operational commander or any operational OPSO or any operational logistics officer will agree that those are very challenging aspects right now because of our 2-to-1 and the fact that we ride our gear and we ride our people hard.
Right.
But I do think that when people get out of that situation and they get to a point where I am right now, where yes, I have my day job, but you know, I'm not operationally deployable. I have time to think. I have time to think about what I just went through and how it can be better and how it can change. And I think there are people out there who are writing about this stuff, who are talking about this stuff, who are working very hard on this very subject, trying to look into the future, which is impossible, and then trying to figure out in our current resource environment, how do we do better? So I am confident that the Corps still has those thinkers out there. Maybe not as congregated as, you know, in the past that you just spoke about.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of that,
I think they're hungry for change.
Yeah, a lot of that was just by accident. You know, I mean, it was just good fortune. And, I mean, I think it changed all of our lives. It certainly changed the way, in fact, I just had Chris Bronzi on, Lieutenant Colonel type, Colonel Select, doing a battle study. And he talked about his time at the basic school in IOC and how it changed him professionally and turned him into a professional. And so it's pretty interesting. But again, some of that is just good fortune. All right, let's talk about infantry level, entry-level training. Give me the thesis of the article.
So essentially the thesis of the article is that to be successful in future conflicts, we as a Corps must change our training and development models for enlisted Marine infantrymen. Hands down. Our current training model is really based off of a 1980s construct. It was good for the times that it served, but you know, things change, and we gotta adapt, and we gotta change with the times.
Okay, talk to us. Your article, the first section is entitled "A Short Look at History." So, in terms of illustrating what you're talking about, walk us through what does history teach us about the way we train and fight?
So So history teaches us a lot, obviously, but what I chose to highlight in this article is that it teaches us really two salient points. Number one, the dominant country, nation, whatever, that is in power often repeats what got them into power. So it finds success and it holds on to that success and it believes that its formula of success is unique. Its culture is unique.
Right.
It can't be topped. It can't be beaten. And anybody who says otherwise is a heretic. And then they find out very, very brutally that the people rising up figure out your weaknesses. They adapt technologies in ways you didn't think about it. They adapt techniques in ways you didn't think about. They negate your advantages. And then all of a sudden you wake up and you're not on top. We saw it with the Romans. We saw it with Napoleon. We saw it with Germany. We saw it with the U.S. in Vietnam. I think we saw it again with the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan. That, you know, just because you have a corner on big technology and big budgets and big military doesn't mean you're always going to win. The second thing that history really teaches us is that the battlefield is constantly getting larger. And the base unit of fighting is constantly getting smaller. So if you look back in China, for example, in 2500 BC or in Greece around 1200 BC, there were mass armies, right? Phalanxes, lots of people, really, really close. And that was the base unit. It was just a whole lot of dudes running in one direction and it turned into a big old brawl.
Right.
Over time, as the longbow came into effect, as gunpowder came into effect, as the cartridge for the repeating rifle came into effect, as the Gatling gun and later the machine gun, artillery, all these innovations, all these changes in technology, the mass army couldn't survive. It had to disperse. And first that was the battalion levels, then the company levels, then the platoons, squads, so on and so forth. The lethality of the battlefield is continuing to increase. That is the steady march of the history of warfare. The battlefield always gets more lethal. And when that lethality rises, the fighting unit must get smaller so that it is more survivable. But when you make a unit smaller, the value of the individual in that person's training and that person's ability to employ his weapons and synchronize with his teammates becomes exponentially more important. So you couldn't take a Genghis Khan warrior today and expect him to win because he would not have the training or the capability in that small unit level. Just like you couldn't take a guy today and expect him to stand shoulder to shoulder with a musket. Wouldn't work.
Okay.
So that is the premise of the history section of the article.
Okay. Let me ask you a question about your comments about Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. There's a lot of people that would say that we didn't lose a battle in Vietnam. They would also make the same argument in Iraq and Afghanistan. But when a nation misapplies its military force, you can only do what you can do. Speak to that, because I remember friends telling me that we're going to go to Iraq, and I said, we're not going to Iraq, we're not doing that. You know, we can contain the Soviet Union for 60 years, and we can't deal with this idiot. And they said, oh no, we're going. And we went. Right, and we destabilized the entire Middle East in that adventure. The arrogance
Absolutely.
Of Don Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, George Bush, all of that. So talk to me. And so what I would say is it's the misapplication of military force. The decision to expand the ground war and stay in Afghanistan. Who in their right mind would want to own Afghanistan if Iraq and if Iraq's or Germany and Japan are 50, 60-year post-war events, what are Iraq and Afghanistan, 1,050? You're attempting to create something that's never existed in the history of the region, let alone the nation. And so, speak to the misapplication of military force, and then what's left to the military in those complex situations.
So when we talk about misapplication, I'm going to focus on two things. I'm going to focus on three things. I'm going to talk about national strategy.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about operational design, and then I'm going to talk about the very, very basics of tactics and how we train for and employ that.
Okay.
So here's our strategy. We decided to fight a Western European war in all three of those instances in an Asian country,
right.
Middle East. Okay? So we are, you know, we lined up for Iraq. Let's talk off one. We lined up for Iraq and we ran ITX.
Oh, absolutely.
And it went great because the other side decided to be the Green Ivans of ITX.
Right.
And they, the Iraqis, they, the Chinese, looked at that and said, oh man, they do this in California like every other week. You know, not a good idea to fight like this. And guess what? No one has fought like that since. All right? The next time we went to Iraq, there was Fedayeen. Oh man. And the army didn't like stand in nice pretty rows and get blown up by all our technology. Now we still won the conventional fight, but we quickly learned that the asymmetrical fight, whether that is ambushes, IEDs, whether that is information warfare, and going after the public opinion and going after the psychology of the U.S. population for supporting the conflict, they found success. They being the Viet Cong, they being the Iraqis, they being the Afghanis. So our strategy overall, like you said, we're trying to put a Jeffersonian democracy into a spot that doesn't exist. That's the wrong strategy. And we can go off on tangents on that, but I'll refrain from doing that one. Operational design, again, you know, when we went into South Vietnam, it was search and destroy. The same thing the Soviets tried to do later on in Afghanistan, search and destroy. You can't kill your way out of an insurgency. It doesn't work. We can go back to the Boer Wars with the Brits. We can go back to the American Revolution and figure that out. You don't kill your way out of a political issue, which is a revolution. You can bring security. And we kind of figured that out with the surge, right? Bring security, buy breathing space for a political
solution,
end state. Right? That's all the military can do.
Right. No, and it's interesting. You look at 50 years ago, the Tet Offensive is going on, right? The Viet Cong were essentially destroyed during the Tet Offensive. And the North Vietnamese Army wasn't capable of offensive operations and for another 4 years in any kind of broad context. And yet, you know, you don't hear that discussed when you hear Tet. You hear the Tet Offensive. You don't hear the Tet Annihilation, which is what it turned out to be. And then when you link it to its own strategy. So again, I don't want to get off the subject, but we have a problem at the general officer level. I mean, because in every one of these disasters, we're escorted there by the general and flag officers of the United States military who aren't willing to do what Greg Newbold did, which is said, hey, look, I'm not going to be a part of this. It's wrong because it's not going to lead to success. And so I have problems with our general officers. I think they're failing the nation by allowing us to get involved, you know. And then, you know, we had to go to Afghanistan, right? I get that. You got to go whack the shit out of them. And then at the end of it, you look at them, and I'll quote General Zinni, and you say, look, if you stack two bricks on top of it and these guys are running around, we have the means. We'll destroy it. We're not going to stay here, though, and die for this place. Because you don't want to die for Afghanistan, and if you've read any of the history of the nation, it's never been a nation state. It's been a series of city states, fiefdoms, under tribal leadership. And so
right.
The OPT that says, yeah, we're going to expand the ground war in this thing, well, then you better tell the American people that you're going to be there for 120 years because that's what it's going to take to create something that's never existed in that part of the world. And short of doing that, to me, that's immoral. I mean,
I would play a little bit of a devil's advocate here.
Go ahead.
Because I don't disagree that we're being failed at the top levels. I don't know if it's always a general officer. So imagine you are the CENTCOM commander.
Okay.
And the President of the United States comes to you and says, I'm invading Iraq.
Okay.
You have two choices. You can say, well, sir, I disagree, and here's all the reasons why.
Okay.
And then he comes back and says, I don't care. The political will of this country is we're going to invade Iraq.
Okay.
So now you either resign.
Right.
Or you say, okay, if the military is going to be forced to eat this turd, maybe by me staying here, I can try and help. I can try and be better. I don't know.
And that's what they do.
I don't know because I've never been a part of those closed-door conversations.
And that's what they do because I have been because I've asked. And the appropriate thing to do is you resign. Okay, when your head of CENTCOM and the Secretary of Defense rips up the war plan and starts writing his own, like Don Rumsfeld did, you know, Tony Sinney told me, because I'm not a general officer, I wasn't familiar with the war plan. He said, Mac, everything that happened in Iraq was predicted. You can't send the military home. Okay, you've got to keep them employed. You've got to employ the border patrol. You've got to employ the police force. You got to keep them all on the payroll. That whole thing has to continue, or else the nation will fall apart and disintegrate in the Civil War. It was written in the estimate of the situation, and every time we war gamed it, the same thing happened. But you had an arrogant Secretary of Defense who ripped up the war plan and wrote his own. Hey, we're going to have special forces guys. We're going to do it on the cheap. You know, we're going to bring somebody else over. They're going to take it. And then so was there nobody in the OPT that stuck their hand up and said, hey, I think it's all great, and I think the parade in Baghdad is going to be awesome. What happens if it doesn't go like that? And Shinseki got shown the door when he said, you're going to need, you know, 200,000 to 300,000, you know, to garrison that. That's what it's going to take. And Rumsfeld showed him the door. And so to me, you have a moral obligation to the nation to resign. And we don't have enough people that'll do that. We know that we didn't have enough guys in Al Anbar. Ask anybody who served there until the surge. We didn't have enough. Was there one general officer that came home to the United States and said, I need to testify in front of Senator McCain? We're playing whack-a-mole. We can cool that place out, but you've got to give us the resources that we need in terms of boots on the ground to do that. No. And where were they in Afghanistan when the decision was made to expand the war? Look, if we're not going to be here for 70, 80, 90 years, then we can't do this because we can't change it in the short term. And so I think we have a moral, you know, failure at the very top that gets us into these events that the military doesn't belong in and then keeps us there and bad things happen. So,
I think you're right on that point. And again, there's certain levels that, you know, I can surmise, but I generally believe that the majority of our senior leaders probably try to speak up, and then, you know, when they're told to sit down, shut up, and color,
they do.
They probably weigh the pros and cons of, well, can I make a difference? Where can I make the best difference? And I think that they look at good intentions. I think the larger issue at that level is the civil military relationship and, you know, where advice is taken, where advice is asked of, and you know, that's a whole other can of worms.
No, but I think it's a great, because you go back to Vietnam, and I wish I could remember, I think his name's General, he was the Chief of Staff of the Army, name's Johnston, that said, I have to go to bed at night, and I have to live with not speaking up, and I have to take that to my grave, because I didn't speak up when I should have. And I do believe, and you're exactly right. That's what they think. Well, you know, if I say, you know, if I put my stars on the table and say this is not right, they're just going to get somebody else. I've worked my whole life to get here. You know, I mean, I'm probably the best guy to manage this whole thing. That's not what the country needs. The country needs people that will say no. And Colin Powell is a great example of it. I had friends who were general officers, lieutenant, three-star types, that told me that we're not going to war in Iraq because Powell won't let us. Our legacy post-Vietnam is that we haven't got, and up to this point, right, we haven't done Iraq yet, right? We've done Desert Storm, right, which was the most pristine war that will ever happen on the planet, okay?
Right.
And so he told me, he said, yeah, Powell won't let him do it. I said, really? And he said, yeah. He said, the case, the WMD case is so weak, it's ridiculous. So I watched with great interest when Colin Powell went to the UN, and I watched that bowl of spaghetti that he served everybody, and I thought, that's it? There's elements of some components that maybe someday might be converted WMD, and we're going to go to war over that, and everybody's going to buy it? And when I talked to my friend, he was crushed. He said at the end of the day, the president looked at him and said, exactly what you're saying. You're my Secretary of State. I need you. The nation needs you. And Powell flinched. And I think history will judge him harshly, because all the displacement of people, you could argue the destabilization of Europe right now because of Muslim refugees, and that cultural class has all been at the hands of the United States and what we unleashed in Iraq. And so
we definitely own that problem, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And
anyway, we're getting off subject.
Vietnam,
it's the root.
At the tactical level, and I'll answer your battle. We never lost a battle question.
Right.
So you're absolutely right. We never lost a battle. And the problem is the enemy wasn't fighting battles. The enemy was, they were causing casualties. And we were not trained, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, to deal with that. We were not trained until Combat Hunter came along and until some of these other programs came in to read culture. We weren't trained to sniff out ambushes, to sniff out IEDs, to understand, you know, telltale signs, to read a local population and know if, you know, danger's lurking or not. We weren't trained for that. We were trained for ITX. And lo and behold, we're still trained for ITX. So, yes, we never lost a battle. Problem is, the enemy wasn't fighting battles. So you can't say you never lost a football game when the other team's not playing football, they're playing basketball.
No, I think it's pretty sobering for most people to watch the Burns Novick documentary recently when you hear, the casualties didn't matter to the North Vietnamese. We took them, but it doesn't matter. And you just, wait a minute, it doesn't matter? So this is going to be forever. So you can't fight a limited war against them because they'll never quit. So interesting. So we're playing one sport and they're playing another. All right, so keep going. So translate this down to migrate this down to entry-level training. In our current training pipeline, and make sense of it.
So really, what this comes down to is, you know, what kind of player do you need to win the game?
Okay.
What kind of Marine do we need to win on the battlefield? Our current training pipeline is 43 days. So what we are saying is that in 43 days, we will take a basically trained Marine out of boot camp. And we're going to make him ready to step onto a battlefield that involves sensors that can see him, sensors that can hear him, optics and lasers that can pinpoint him, weapons, drones, smart mines, you name it, that can hunt him and kill him without ever seeing another human being. 43 days. We're going to do that. I don't buy it, okay? Because in 43 days, what we teach that Marine...
We're going to introduce him. How about this? We're going to introduce him to those concepts in 43 days.
We're not even introducing him to those concepts. We're teaching him what a tree line is and how to put on face paint. We're teaching him acronyms that he can spot out. BAMSIS, you know,
right.
We're teaching him how to basically employ his weapon.
Okay.
But then when the Marine gets to the fleet, he is capable of, I'm up, they see me, I'm down. He is capable of taking apart his weapon, cleaning it, putting it back together, basic field craft, basic field sanitation, pretty decent marksmanship. I think our pipelines do that very well.
Okay.
You know, hand and arm signals, really, really basic stuff. What he is not capable of doing, no fault to the Marine, is understanding the interplay of suppressive fire, effects on the enemy, and what that allows him to do, how that allows him to maneuver. And we see it. We get on the golf course, and we get on the ranges, and it's, I'm up, I run five steps, I lay down. I'm not under cover. The suppression's already stopped, but it doesn't matter because I was trained to get up and down, up and down. So the ability to understand and then to take that into a chaotic environment and make decisions when he is physically and audibly separated from his leadership, which we saw in the urban environments,
right,
doesn't exist. Every time I bring this up, I get some, you know, I get a gunner or I get a gunner sergeant or a staff sergeant who's like, sir, you got it all wrong. I need them basically trained, and then I'll train them up. I'll get them ready. My argument always back. Yes, gunny. Yes, gunner. Yes, staff sergeant, you will. But that's not your job. Your job is not to train the Marine. Your job is to forge the team. Your job is to employ the team of really, really, really well-trained Marines. You're not going to give an NFL coach a high school football player. You're going to give them someone who has been trained really, really well, and you're going to put them in a team of really well-trained other people, and then that coach is going to take all those well-trained individuals and turn them into a Super Bowl team. He's not there to teach you how to tackle. He's there to teach you how to tackle during plays with other blocking schemes, you name it. So we need more time in a controlled environment to not only introduce the weapons, introduce the gear, introduce the tactics, but to refine it, refine it, refine it, refine it, so that the Marine understands how all this works together and how he can be most lethal on the battlefield and how he can survive that battle.
Okay, now I'm going to throw my manpower hat on. My guest this morning is Major Chad Buckle. We're talking about a series of articles that he's written, and this one that we're talking about is entry-level training. And, Chad, what, where can they find this article? It's already appeared in the Gazette, yes?
Yes, this one's already appeared in the Marine Corps Gazette, I believe the February edition.
Okay, all right. All right, so now I'm a manpower guy, and you're like, okay, I've got 43 training days, right, and I've got this model that's built. All right, Major, how many training days do you need to get this asset of ours, this infantry asset of ours, to a level of training that they can come in and be on a Super Bowl contending team?
Okay, and I would come back to you and say, I need 250 calendar days, which is 180 training days. And I would tell you we need to break this down into three phases. We need to take 90 training days, or 60 training days, all right? And we need to work basic skills. That's physical fitness, okay? That's combat hunter. That's tactical combat casualty care. That's how to do a METTC analysis, how to work over a terrain model and understand what's being told to you and be able to brief it back, how the orders process works and how information is fed to you, the language of the orders process. We need to get in there, and we need to put them through a green belt course so they understand what close combat is, not to turn them into Chuck Norris, but to make them understand the interpersonal violence of close combat and how to control their breathing, how to control fear, how to control their emotions. We need to teach them land navigation. I mean, really, really teach them how to read the terrain and read a map and take a compass and move from point A to point B. And we need to teach them close quarter battle with every single weapon in an infantry squad. And not just fam fire it, but make them experts on those weapons.
Okay, so this is post-recruit training, or do we do away with recruit training?
Yes, absolutely. This is an SOI.
All right.
So, you know, we do our table one and table two in recruit training, and we kind of gloss over the other tables. But if they're not hitting black, then they need to go back to that table over and over and over again until it's one fluid motion. We need to teach them how to employ UASs and what those things can do for them. We need to teach them how to build field expedient antennas so that they can communicate in a denied environment.
Okay, so that's 60 days for those basic skills.
That's 60 days.
All right, then what?
That's the science, right? The science behind the art.
Right.
Teach them the gear. Teach them the tactics.
Got it.
Phase two, another 60 days. 60 training days, 84 calendar days. Right? That's where we're going to work on patrolling, infiltration, exfiltration, ambush, and raid operations at the squad level. And when I say we're going to work on that, think about the basic reconnaissance course. Think about ranger training, where you leave on a Sunday night, Monday morning, and you come home Friday night, Saturday morning, and you're part of a team, and you rotate the billet two or three times a day, and you just do it, do it, do it, and you AAR it, you hot wash it after every single run, and you get feedback from your instructor, and you get feedback from your teammates, you talk about what you did wrong, you talk about what you did right, and you turn around, you do it again. And you show progressing, and you work on those weaknesses. You know, when we talk about being able to move through an environment, when we talk about being able to move undetected, infiltration and exfiltration operations, being able to ambush someone, being able to execute a successful raid, which is a very, very difficult operation,
right,
that takes a lot of practice. And the beautiful part of this is while you're doing this, you're using all of your science from phase one, all of your basic skills. You're building your antennas. You're working your casualty plans. You're working your marksmanship. And you're seeing how the individual skills enhance the ability of the fire team and the squad.
Okay, so that's 60.
And we know it works because we have models in the DoD that do that right now.
Okay, so that's six. That's another 60 training days. All right.
Yep.
What's after that?
All right, after that, we're going to work on offense and defense. Again, 60 training days, 84 calendar days. This is where, you know, for the defense, we're not just making a fire plan sketch, but we're understanding how those fires interlock with each other. We're understanding how these cards actually communicate and what their importance is. We're building fighting positions properly with a parapet that can actually stop a bullet or stacking sandbags that can stop a round. We're emplacing crew serve weapons, and we're talking about why we emplace the crew serve weapons where they are. We talk about how we protect those crew serve weapons, and we're doing that, and we're practicing it. Support by fire positions in the offense. What they actually do for you, how the shift signals should work, the effects they should cause before I commit my force. Even at that fire team level, suppressing for another fire team. It doesn't have to be large scale. Understanding how to read an enemy's reaction to your actions and then give that counteraction that can defeat that enemy and keep you alive. We're talking about reduction of bunkers and reduction of strong points and how those, again, fire and maneuver, how moving from cover to cover, how attacking a position at its weakest point after you've probed it and you understand it. How to bring in rockets and cruiser weapons, how to breach, appropriately breach, and not just be able to say SOSRA, but actually do it and see it and understand it. And again, gauge the environment, gauge the enemy's reaction, and react off of that instead of just doing it because the smoke went up. This is also a time when we can get our weapons Marines to really learn their system and then use that supporting the riflemen, so that each side can truly understand what, you know, what those weapons Marines bring to the fight, and those weapons Marines truly understand what their weapons can do for the 0311.
All right, Chad. Here's the comment that comes into my head.
Right.
Okay. Great job with the good idea, Ferry, but this isn't practical. It would take way too long for Marines to get to the fleet, and the operating force would be undermanned. So,
isn't the operating force already undermanned?
Constantly.
Okay, so I already got that problem. And it's a good point. So yes.
Actually, truth.
So now we have to change.
In the interest of truth, I stole that out of his article. Okay, he says that himself. So I teed it up for it. So make it sense. Make it make sense. How do we implement this system?
So the first thing we do is we don't keep putting powdered sugar on a turd.
Okay.
You get rid of the turd, and you make a new system. You break the model that we currently have. You throw it away. You recreate a new model. All right? Our manpower model right now does not support what the fleet needs. And I understand it's a very bold statement. I understand there's going to be some people out there who are going to vehemently disagree with me.
Right.
And I would love to have the conversation, but it doesn't, because we're already undermanned and we're already undertrained. So it ain't working. So here's what I recommend. If somebody says, I'm going to go be infantry, you say, great, Johnny. You're signing up, for a 5-year contract. Okay. And you're going to be, that's going to be your initial enlistment. You're going to spend 1 year in training between boot camp and SOI. 1 year. We're going to take 1 year to take this 18-year-old and turn him into the type of Marine we need on the battlefield. All right, and that gives us 4 years in the operating forces. That's 2 deployments, plus time for him to either process out properly and receive the support he needs to transition on, or time for him to say, yep, I'm sticking around, I like the gun club, and then we can move him on to the second article in the career path. I'll save that one for the next one. So now we got to talk about throughput.
Right. Well, yeah. Right? What does this mean to our throughput when we're going to park this many bodies in this state for this this period of time?
So both SOIs are going to have to grow. All right. So right now, the current schoolhouse, and I'm kind of using Master Marines here, so forgive me with this, but based off of the research that I was able to grab. And talking with some of the instructors out on the West Coast, there are about 25 combat instructors to about 250 to 300 students per company. Okay, that's a 1 to 10 to 1 to 12 ratio instructor to student. And about 24, 25 squads. I never do math in public, so I'm really breaking some rules here. But that's what we currently have. All right, if you break that down even further, that's about 100 combat instructors at the schoolhouse. That schoolhouse graduates about 4,000 students a year for about 8,000 infantry Marines per year across the Corps. So that's where we are right now. All right, 8,000 infantry Marines under the current construct. So what I'm saying is, okay, if that's kind of the litmus test, 8,000, here's how we do this with the extended time frame. We're going to have to expand the SOIs. All right, so you fix each company at 360 students and 30 combat instructors. All right, 30 combat instructors, sergeants, and we'll talk about that in the second article and why sergeants is important.
Okay.
And 5 combat instructors, staff sergeants, per company. All right, that's 5 platoons, 4 platoons of 0-11s, 1 platoon of weapons, 6 squads at 12 students per squad. All right, the 13th being the sergeant instructor. So 1 sergeant, 12 students.
Okay.
All right. Each platoon is commanded by a staff sergeant. So we're mimicking the fleet here. We're doing all right.
All right.
That's a 1 to 12 instructor to student ratio.
Okay.
That's exactly what we have right now.
Okay.
But it gets better. Now we're going to take this battalion, and we're going to increase the battalion from 4 companies to 8 companies. So we're going to double the size of the training battalion. And if you do that and you put a 3-week gap in between each training company's training day 1, that means there would be 50 combat instructors in phase 2, 50 combat instructors, I'm sorry, we would put 50 combat instructors as phase 2 instructors and 50 other combat instructors as phase 3 instructors. So now we're increasing the number of our combat instructors.
Okay.
So now we're really getting into some manpower, heaviness, all right?
All right. Where are they coming from? They keep going.
Yeah, we're going to get there. By putting, so you allow the individual squad instructor to work with his 12 Marines in phase 1 by himself.
Got it.
When he moves to phase 2 and phase 3, okay, that means there's an extra 16 combat instructors per phase as companies rotate through.
Got it.
Which drops your ratio to 1 to 8.
Okay.
For student or for instructor to student.
Right.
So as you get into the higher level stuff such as the patrolling and the offense and defense, you're dropping the instructor to student ratio, so there's more time to train that individual Marine.
Okay, but we're assuming that the squad leader is competent to teach in phase 2 and 3.
Absolutely. So our newer instructors would essentially be the squad leader, and our more senior instructors who have been there maybe a year or two would be the phase instructors. So
okay.
There would be kind of a tier system here.
Yep, makes sense.
Which also works, again, we'll talk about in the second article, but the development of our squad leaders before they go back to the fleet and how that pays off in the long run. So let's talk. Now we're going to talk numbers. I'm going to bore everybody here. So this means that each battalion would have 40 staff sergeants and 340 sergeant combat instructors. Okay? Corps-wide total between the two SOI, 80 staff sergeants and 680 sergeants. That's a lot. And right now, I think people are probably turning the radio off.
Yeah, you just broke it. Like, okay.
Right. Or did I? That would produce about 8,000 students, give or take, across the Corps.
All right. Is that what we currently produce on an annual basis?
And that's what we currently produce. So we have matched output.
Okay.
So now your listeners are like, really? 680 sergeants?
Yeah.
Right.
Good one.
You're smoking crack. Okay. So let's look at fiscal year 2016.
Okay.
There were 710 first term O3XX Marines that decided to reenlist. And that excludes our 03, 72s, and 21s.
All right.
Okay, 710. Remember, the magic number is 680.
Okay.
So right there, in 1 year, there was enough that graduated. That was out of an available boat space of 769. Okay, so the numbers are there. Now, only 46, from what I pulled from the boat space report, decided to go on the squad leader development program, 0365. All right. That was in the infancy. I'm sure those numbers have risen since then. But we're looking at 2016, 2 years ago.
Okay.
Now, if we made SLDP mandatory, and we said that, hey, if you're going to stick around in the infantry, you're going to go through this program, and you're going to go through the schoolhouse. Again, we'll talk about that in the career path. Then the goal of 680 is really not as steep as it seems. Because if an instructor reenlists for 4 more years, and we put him through 1 year of training to make him a pristine instructor,
okay,
and 3 years instructing, then the population can be broken down into fourths, which means I need 170 sergeants per year out of a population of 769. So it's not as insurmountable, again, if you recreate the model and you change the model, not just try to put a patch on what we have, the numbers work. You just got to change the model. That's still, though, a very, very high tax on the infantry. And what that means is that if you want a future as a squad leader, you're not going to recruiting. You're not going to be a drill instructor. You're not going anywhere else but SOI.
You got to stay.
So now we're going to funnel.
Yeah, you got to stay in your MOS in order to be competitive for promotion, and in order for the system to work, you got to stay in your MOS.
Absolutely. So again, there's going to be trade-offs, but the numbers exist if we use the numbers appropriately. and then we train, we invest in that talent, which, again, talk about in the career path, then the numbers work. The numbers are there.
All right. My guest today is Major Chad Buckle. He's from Louisiana. He's written a series of articles, three of which have already appeared in the Marine Corps Gazette, and they focus on the quality issue and then reverse engineering a series of solutions based on the quality of warfighter that you need given today's technological sophistication and the lethality and the dispersed nature of future battlefields. All right. I can hear, a whole series of questions, but I'll ask you one last question, and you can, because I think you've made your case pretty convincingly, all right, that if this and this, then therefore this, and if you believe that, then this is how you have to pay for it. Talk to me about today's battlefield being so much different than other battlefields. Battlefields have evolved since the beginning of fighting. So why, and the Marine Corps has constantly evolved its training, and we haven't simply relied on one construct. We've evolved the squad. We've changed weaponry. We've changed vehicles. We've constantly evolved the product. What requires such a drastic change in the Marine Corps that other, evidently, time periods did not? Because we've essentially stayed with it, with the pre-World War II model or World War II model in our squads, our fire teams, our level of organizations. We've tweaked that, and we've tweaked our pipeline. We've created schools of infantry. We've created the infantry officer course. But now you're talking about taking even those concepts and putting them on steroids and really divorcing the historical relationship that they've had with the past. So what is the current requirement that forces that on us?
So I don't see this as a divorce of our history. Okay. I see this as an evolution of it. I'm sure if you went back to the creation of the SOIs, there were people, senior enlisted and officers in the Corps that said, we don't need SOI.
Right.
Every Marine's a rifleman. Every Marine's infantry. We can just train them up, put them on the front line. Look, it worked in Korea.
Right. Worked in, World War II.
And fire brigade. They were successful, right. and we landed on Incheon with, a ragtag team that we scrapped together from across the Corps.
Right.
But those were still industrial wars. Those were still wars of district. They were not wars of technology. And when I say that is, we could mass fires, we could mass forces, we could take an operational pause, we could annihilate entire mountain ranges and beachheads, and then land landing force and accept ungodly casualties because it was a conscript military. There were volunteers, yes, but it was, by and large conscript, and it was by and large an industrial output. The value, if I could, say this without sounding really, really horrible, but the value of the individual was less because the amount of money the government spent in the training and equipping of that individual was much less. But that model will not survive on a modern battlefield. The American population and the U.S. military won't accept it.
We invest
so much in talent management and in talent development to make a smarter strategic corporal that when we lose that individual, it not only hurts on a personal level, but it hurts on a resource level. They're hard. The true talent is really, really hard to replace. And if we don't build that talent, if we don't proliferate that talent, if we don't build more of that talent, instead of just waiting for the John Bassalones to show up, and they do. They do in droves, even today.
Right.
But if we don't institutionalize that and build that and make everyone into a John Best loan, or at least make everybody capable of understanding, you know, how to operate effectively on the battlefield and how to be more lethal, then all we're doing is wasting lives. We're wasting our Marines. And that is a moral failure if we want to talk about that.
You know what? I would pile on to it. If you go through our conflicts, I would tell you that our center of gravity is the television into the American living room. And that when we go to fight wars, the nation will accept casualties, but not for very long. And so to me, your force has to be lethal. In my opinion, it ought to be larger rather than smaller, because you can't fight sustained wars as a nation in the United States. And I will tell you that what we're doing today, in what we did in Syria here recently, is a little bit of a shift in that we're participating in kinetic operations as advisors, and it might be that it works because of the maturation process that the Iraqi army has gone through, and that they're a little bit more capable, which allows us to be in the background. And so we can be involved because we're not taking casualties. Because the American public gets to a breaking point where they say, we don't care anymore. To the point, and Vietnam's a good example. You know, Tet annihilates the NVA soldiers that came south. And it's really interesting to read it from their perspective, a book called The Sorrow of War, written by an NVA soldier. He talks about the hopelessness of fighting against American firepower, and what's that like to be in a regiment of 500 and be one of 10 that survives, and knowing right. that you're going to go to a re-education camp with the political officers and then go back to the front lines. And there's this black humor that would make the Poles look like optimists. And so so to me, I think one of the other arguments is a strategic argument relative to our own center of gravity, which is when we go to war, we need to be larger and we need to be more lethal, because we cannot fight a sustained conflict because the American people won't take it. So
here's the other part of this. Our enemy, all right, our potential adversaries, our current adversaries, they've upped their games.
And they know what our center of gravity is too. They read Vietnam. Well,
and they know that if they close on our small units, if they close in on our close combat units, we cannot bring firepower to bear. So everybody takes for granted that we're going to have CAS, you know, airstrikes, and we're going to have artillery. Well, I can tell you, and many of your viewers can probably tell you from very close personal experience, that don't work when they're across the street. And now it's organic fires. And now it's man-to-man. And when you go into that building, there are no fires. It's your training. It's the training of the Marine next to you, and that's what gets you through the fight.
You know, and I'll tell you, one of the great epiphanies, Chad, from that Vietnam series was, for the first time that I can remember, is seeing NVA soldiers, Viet Cong soldiers, talk about what it was like to fight us. I'd never seen it in that volume, and I thought it was the most fascinating part of the documentary. And they talk about, you know, having to grab Americans by the belt buckle, because if there's any daylight, you will be annihilated. You know, and talking about what it's like to see, you know, your company engulfed in napalm. And so not only that, they do the same thing in Iraq and Afghanistan. In Iraq, I can recall our intel guys capturing, you know, the DVDs they'd make, you know, with their music and their songs on it, showing headshots and sniper shots, just saying, keep killing them. They quit in, they were fought to a stalemate in Korea. They quit in Vietnam. They quit in Lebanon. Right after the barracks fell down, they got their nose bloodied when a Black Hawk got brought down and their bodies were mutilated and drugged through the street in Somalia. They left there, right? They left without a conclusive victory in Iraq. You know, they already left once in Afghanistan. Kill them. Continue to kill them. And then I remember vividly, this is kind of a bad memory, but I remember the video of Harry Reid saying the war is lost. As the he was a Senate Majority Leader at the time, and so they know our history. They know our soft spot, And I would argue that, you know, we have to be more lethal because we, as a democracy, can't stand that video to come into our, just recently in Iraq in 2004, there's a presidential election going on and we're sitting around Fallujah and what do we get told? Hey, stop. I mean, and that came from Karl Rove, for God's sakes. Hey, we can't get you reelected if you continue to allow the Marines, and this video of them bleeding and dying keeps coming back. You've got to pause them. And we got told, stop until the election. You can go within 48 hours of the election. Got it. All right, thanks. All politics. So,
you know, another side of this is there's this a gentleman, Scales, and he wrote a book. And he quoted, and I'm going to probably misquote this, so I'm going to apologize to the author and to your audience, something like 60 or 70% of America's casualties have been from close combat units. 60 to 70%. And that our kill ratio in the air, while it's like 1 to a bajillion, on the ground is closer to 1 to 1.
Right.
So when you break it down to science and you break it down to numbers, and I read the book, it's a phenomenal book, and I recommend it to your viewers.
What's the name of the book?
Scales on War.
Scales on War. Right.
Scales on War. It's eye opening. And it basically lays out that, you know, because of technology and because of our training, we are at either equal footing or at a disadvantage in the close combat realm when the enemy gets within a certain distance. And what overcomes that is technology, drones, and the employment of micro drones. And we talk about that in the squad, article, but it comes down to training. It comes down to the warfighter who has been inculcated appropriately for the battlefield he's coming into. Think through the problem, and doesn't need the squad leader to tell him what to do, doesn't need the fire team leader to give the instruction. Because he is so good and because he's so well trained, the implicit communication becomes better and the team reacts faster. And that's how you get into an enemy's OODA loop at 50 meters.
And what you're talking about sending to the operating forces is a professional warfighter.
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's what we claim to send now, and we do. I am not disparaging our schools of infantry.
No,
they do
entry level training, and when you
that's
get
what
them,
they do exactly
right. And when you get them in the fleet, your job is to continue that training, and to continue to push them so they can be professionals, and they're not novices. They're not novices anymore. And I don't say, and that's not disparaging. It's simply a time and what they've been exposed to. They're apprentices.
Hey.
And so,
here's what I challenge the Marine Corps. Redefine entry level. Redefine basically trained. That's why we'll still do basic training, but redefine the word basic. Make it better. So that you give a product to that staff sergeant, to that sergeant in the fleet, he's not training this Marine how to put on face paint. He's training this Marine how to operate his SOPs at the squad, platoon, company, battalion level.
All right, we're running
to be more lethal.
We're running the plays. We're making decisions. We're doing the horizontal and vertical coordination that goes with all of that. That makes it go faster.
That's
that
right.
Makes it be more lethal. We're working
that's
on the
right.
We're working on the finished product, the one that gets taken to the enemy, not the elements or components of it. My guest, Chad Buckle, Major Type, United States Marine Corps. This article is entitled
Entry-Level Training.
It was in the Marine Corps Gazette in February. All right, Chad, first of all, I want to thank you for doing this. And very, very interesting stuff. And the next article we'll talk about is what?
Next one we're going to talk about is the career path. So, today we talked about how to get that Marine through his entry level. And you know, make him that better, basically trained Marine. Next, we're going to talk about how we best talent management and develop our enlisted Marines and continue to turn them into world-class athletes, world-class warriors.
All right. And so the construct of now you're going to recruiting, now you're going to embassy duty, now you're going to do other things, You're not going to do that. You're going to stay in your MOS, and we're going to find ways to make you even a stronger warrior. Yes.
Absolutely. The talent is there. The numbers are there. Math works, but we gotta manage that better.
All right.
We gotta invest more in our individual Marines to turn them into the types of squad leaders we quite frankly expect them to be and need them to be. But we are not, as an institution, we are not, as officers, training them to be.
From the great state of Louisiana, by way of the Citadel, Chad Buckle, Major, United States Marine Corps infantry guy, has written a series of articles. Check them out in the Gazette. Chad, again, thanks for doing this and being a guest here on All Marine Radio. We'll do it again in probably the next couple of weeks, if that's okay with you. I'll give you a call and we'll coordinate a time and look forward to continuing this conversation.
I love it. I appreciate your time.
All right. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.